Our two speakers, I'll introduce just briefly our second speaker now. I'll give him a fuller introduction just before he speaks. So Professor Alistair McGrath, who's at the University of Oxford as Professor of Historical Theology. He'll be speaking as the opposer. The proposer of belief in God is a dangerous delusion is Dr. Sue Blackmore. She's a writer, a lecturer, a broadcaster, and a visiting lecturer at UWE. She's done lots of research into memes, into evolutionary theory, consciousness, meditation, but she no longer researches the paranormal. She did a lot of that in her past. Her PhD is in parapsychology, and her first degree is in psychology and physiology from the University of Oxford. She practices Zen, and she campaigns for drug legislation. Just some of the other interesting things about her. She's published over 60 academic papers. She writes a blog for The Guardian, and amongst her many books, she's written The Meme Machine and also textbooks on consciousness. You'll have noticed her hobbling in. She fell off a horse in Greece some time ago. It got hideously infected, and she's been in hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks. We weren't sure that she was going to be able to make it tonight, and it's her first night out for some time. So Sue Blackmore, thank you hugely for making it tonight, and go ahead with proposing the debate.
Thank you. Well, I didn't know she was going to tell you all that, but how thrilling for my first terrifying night out. I've hardly left the house for the last 4 weeks before that I left the BRI. So it's a thrill to have all of you a lot in front of me, egging me on and presumably going to throw eggs at me later on. Belief in God. Well, it's obviously a delusion, but is it a dangerous delusion? I wondered whether the organisers just put that, you know, well, it's a nice alliteration, isn't it? Dangerous delusion. Perhaps they thought equally it could be a harmless delusion or a quaint delusion or even a beneficent delusion. But no, I think they're right. It is a dangerous delusion. First, I must be clear, though, what sort of God I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the deist's God, what you might call the scientist's God, Einstein's God, the God that Paul Davies and Stephen Hawking refer to when they talk about the mind of God. That God is really no more or no less than the entirety of the universe or the laws of physics or something like that. That sort of God doesn't intervene in human affairs, doesn't tell you what to do every day, there's no point in praying to such a God. That God doesn't cause the problems. No, the God I'm talking about is the vile and vengeful God of the Old Testament and the Quran. The God who, on the one hand, is meant to be loving and compassionate, and on the other, advocates torture, killing children, genocide, suppression of women. The God who people pray for. He's supposed to answer prayers, but then all around us the suffering carries on. And we know from all the studies that have been done that the prayers don't get answered, even if perhaps they help the person doing the praying. The God who is supposed to have made us in his own image, even though we know that's not how we got to be looking like this with all our imperfections and so on, and hips that break easily when you fall off horses. The God who gave us dominion over the planet, rather giving us some justification, perhaps, for spoiling it in this way. Gosh, I'm being very negative, aren't I? I didn't really mean to. I'm just trying to describe the God that I learned about in my Christian upbringing and which I've read about in other great books. And, of course, it's the God who fights on both sides in every war. That God. That's the one I'm thinking is dangerous. But is it really so dangerous? Perhaps I've exaggerated all these things. I think, interestingly, the danger is different for individuals from how it is to the whole of society. Now, you could say, if you take an open, tolerant, mixed belief sort of society, the kind of society where it's perfectly acceptable to believe whatever you like as long as you don't harm anybody else, and you take an individual in that society, and they perhaps believe in their own version of God, some kind of compassionate, up there sort of being that helps, that they can pray to, A recent survey this week showed that 40%, I was quite surprised, 40% of Britons pray. I don't know how often they pray or what form their prayer takes. Clearly, they don't go to church. I mean, very few people still go to church or synagogue or mosque, but lots of people are praying. Probably, from what we know from other surveys, the God they believe in is not all of those things I've described. They're not taking on the whole package. It's their own kind of nice, helpful thing there. And can be helpful for that person. It's nice to have something you think you can turn to when you have difficult decisions to make, something to guide you, even if really the guidance is coming from your own conscience. It's nice to believe that somebody cares and that you're special. And when you feel bad about something you've done, that somebody might forgive you or understand. Surely these things are helpful. And belief in life after death, which logically, of course, doesn't have to go with belief in God, although often it does. That can be very comforting when you're facing death or bereavement. So isn't it nice and helpful to that individual? Maybe yes. But I rather think that the cost is not to the individual, the cost is to everybody else. Now, how could that be? One argument is put by Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith. He argues there that the problem with people believing in God, which you have to do on faith in the sense of believing something without or even in spite of the lack of evidence, you have to believe in God in faith because, of course, there isn't any evidence, that of itself is corrosive to society. Because even just some people believing, very moderate kind of believers, are encouraging the idea that it's all right to believe things on faith. I mean, the rest of our life, we don't believe things on faith, do we? I mean, we expect medicines to work and we want somebody to evaluate them. We want to really know what happened in some history, but was it really true this way or was it that way? If our lover's cheating on us, we want to really know whether they were. I mean, you know, the truth matters. You don't just believe something on faith. Perhaps it really is undermining. But more important, I want to make the contrast between just a few people believing something and a whole lot. Because when a whole lot of people start believing in something, then they start clubbing together, and then they start arguing, and then they start erecting barriers, and then the great religions can take hold, and that's where we get the dangers. You may have spied here what looks like a kind of biological or evolutionary kind of an argument. And it's only an analogy, but I am kind of thinking that way. You often get in biology situations where what is good for the individual is not good for the group or vice versa. For example, you may get a species with... Kathy, this isn't doing anything.
I'm turning you here.
If you could make it roughly right and give it back to me, then... Because I don't want to, after all... I was the one who told her to be brutal. I don't want to do it wrong. So you can often get a species in which most of the individuals will behave in some altruistic way, helping each other out and doing good things for each other. This, of course, benefits the group and is good for everybody. But then, of course, it will pay an individual to come in sneakily and take all the advantages and not pay their way. And that individual will then have an advantage and have lots of offspring, and so the whole thing gets overtaken. And, well, you might think all the altruism will be destroyed. In fact, game theory shows that all sorts of other things can happen. You can get into stable states and so on, where, by and large, a group can tolerate a certain number of freeloaders. So there may be analogies here with biology. One needs to be careful with analogies, but I do want to take a good evolutionary look at religions. Thank you. I think it can really help us to think about how religions evolved, how they got the way they did. Because if we can understand how they got to be how they are, perhaps we can see in a more understanding way why they're so horrible and so dangerous. Instead of the usual kind of way of thinking about the origin of religions, I want to take this different evolutionary view. So the classic kind of argument about, let's say, the great holy books is, were they the word of God or were they written by people? Were they, as so many people believe, actually transmitted straight from him up there, who's, after all, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent? I'm not sure how he can kind of squeeze down into a little space to pass on the words, but maybe that's just one of those mysteries. Anyway, that's supposed to have what happened, many people believe, so that these words in these books now are actually the Word of God. Or were they just people who wrote them? Well, all the scholarship, historical research, archaeological research, and so on, shows, of course, that they were people who wrote them, and usually hundreds of years after the events that they were purportedly describing. And you can tell from the inconsistencies and the contradictions and so on that there were lots of people who wrote them. But that's really not the end of the story. That kind of implies, looking back over a sort of continuous chain from now to the invention of these things in the first place. But I want to think of it more in the way one does in evolution, as a great tree, or a really bushy bush, really, of loads and loads and loads of potential religions, or little starting bits of religions, proto-religions, failed religions, that died out. And what we have now are the survivors. They're the tips of the branches of this great bush, where the rest have been pruned off. That's how evolution works. It works by things being varied and different experiments tried and then kill, 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 natural selection, or in this case, human selection, humans preferring some things over other things. And so it's, if you like, design by death. All of biology is designed by death, and I'm going to say that the way religions evolved is also designed by death, operating on masses of different attempts, if you like, at religion. So think back to the times in which the great religions were starting out. A world with far fewer people than today. Scattered villages, small towns, big city-states, but not very much communication between them. But still human beings like us. So you'd expect all over the place to pop up, as indeed they do today, amazing people. People who are great orators, amazingly articulate people with intelligent, fascinating ideas, natural healers, people who just have that kind of, you know, ability to make you feel better, charlatans who could make magic tricks and convince you that they had supernatural powers, people who claim communion with the spirits, epileptics who have amazing visions and manage to describe them and convince people that they've really seen something from another plane or another world, or they've communicated with something beyond. Nowadays, these still appear. They set up smaller or larger cults, and they thrive or die out. I think that's been going on all the time. So you get that sort of popping up all over the world. And then what happens? Well, some of those people have really good ideas or really good ways of doing things. Groups of people form around them, and they start little habits of doing different things or wearing different clothes or whatever it might be. And some of those ideas are kind of sticky. Other people quite like them, and so they join in, and these ideas spread. These habits and skills, memes, get more infectious, and more people join in. So the memeplexes, little groups of memes, start to grow. Now, at first, they're just spreading, you know, not very quickly, and perhaps there's not very much competition. But gradually, over the centuries, things start to hot up. Some very important changes happen during these many centuries since all this began. Firstly, the spread of writing. Because once you actually write something down, then it has a longer life. It has a much more high-fidelity copying. The same words are there. Other people can come and copy the words, or they can learn them by heart. And then different people can choose to copy this bit or this bit. And the bits that somehow or another have whatever it takes to make somebody copy that bit rather than that bit get more copies. And so if you imagine the branches of the tree, these pages of the books get copied more and more, and these ones get forgotten. Or some people might say these are really bad pages, satanic verses or whatever, and they get hidden away, and you know, terrible things happen to the people who copy those and whatever. So there's a spread in the writings, but there's also a spread in the different practices. People start doing different things. They start convincing other people to join them in this kind of way of doing things, this sort of singing, this kind of dancing, that kind of building that they're making. And then the competition is hotted up because there's more people traveling. The great trade routes are opening up, better transport, and so the ideas come into conflict with each other. And what's going to happen when they come into conflict? Well, may the fittest idea win. But this is going to start being a fight. This is going to start getting a bit, well, as it does with animals. I mean, you have with animals, don't you? The Jabberwocky, their jaws that bite, their claws that catch, teeth and beaks and ferocious behaviours and tricks and mimicry and all kinds of things that enable one organism to survive as opposed to another. Similar kind of thing happening here. And I'm not just saying it's analogy, I'm saying it's the same process operating on informational structures spread by human brains as opposed to informational structures stored in DNA and propagated by animals, by organisms. So it's a competition between groups of ideas to get into as many heads as they can and persuade those physical bodies to propagate them further. What kind of tricks are going to work? Well, by and large, carrots. And if they don't work, add in a few sticks. So what are the carrots? Well, let's have a really nice idea. Like, let's have a god, you know, somebody who loves you. Somebody who cares about you and makes you feel special, because don't we all want to feel special? Somebody who gives a reason for it to be like this, even if it's not really a very convincing reason. But, you know, this is how we got this way. This is why it's like this. This is why there's suffering in the world. This is what you can do about it. Then there's comforting with life after death. That's always a good one. But if that doesn't work, you can make some really fantastic promises. You can promise nice things in this life. You can promise beautiful buildings and lovely music. You can promise companionship and friendship and feeling good because you're in a group who believes the same as you. And you can also promise ours is better than the other group. You're going to be a good person. You're going to be an altruistic person. All those other people out there are dreadful. You can promise all kinds of things. And if that doesn't work, you can add really extravagant promises. You can't fulfill them, but a promise of heaven forever, that will be really fantastic. What are we going to promise in heaven? Really fast computer, amazing broadband, every bit of internet. No, of course not. But what do people want? Food, sex, peace and quiet and everlasting contentment. They'll get all that. Manna in heaven, 72 virgins, everlasting bliss. You can promise that after they're dead and they can't check. You can't go out and do what you do with a scientific idea or a medicine or a historical fact and find out until you die. Okay, fine, that's fine. I'll believe it on faith. Now, if all that doesn't work, now imagine there's all these... Think through, not somebody thinking this way and designing it. No. Think competition all over the planet. Different versions competing with each other to get into different minds and force those minds to propagate them. So... if that's not enough, get the big guns out. Get the sticks as well. Okay, let's have some really big sticks. You believe this, or worse still, you were born into this and you didn't have a choice, and by the time you're old enough, you'd already got it. Thank you. The really big sticks, if you give up on this belief, you will be killed. Do people really go and kill people for giving up on... Oh, yes, they do. Even here in Britain today. Just very recently was founded the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. And the founder of that organization has had lots and lots of death threats and threats against the family and so on. And there are people out there actually carrying this out, as you well know. But if you don't want to go that far and have those kinds of threats, well, threats are in hell, of course, and there are plenty of hells. I think, you know, when I was a kid, well, I was by the time I really thought about it, I was so used to the Old Testament that I just kind of accepted that this horrible thing. But I was an adult when I first read the Quran, and I read all this stuff about garments of fire have been prepared for the unbeliever, and they'll be lashed with rods of iron, and if they try to escape, they'll be dragged back screaming and kicking by angels. Why do people believe these? Why do they believe them? Because of this long history of these ideas have been honed to the human mind. They've been co-adapted, they've co-evolved along with the human mind to be spread by human beings. That's why they're this way. And they have to be protective as well as their identity, just as the reason why organisms exist at all is that they keep as a neat package all the genes together so that the tricks will protect all the genes. So with religions, you don't take a little bit from this one and a little bit from that. No, you get the whole thing. You are, if you're a convert, you have to learn things by heart and promise to stick with them all. But if you're given it when you're young, you have to learn the catechism by heart. You have to learn the verses from the Quran. You have to go to and be schooled in all these things. And you also wear special hats or special veils, or you in some way are marked, or you mutilate your children in infancy so that they're marked for the rest of their life as belonging to it. All kinds of markers to keep these together. These are all the tricks. Well, no, they're not all the tricks. There are much more subtle tricks. Don't laugh at me. Oh, no. No. Laughter is the best way to deal with silly ideas. So you've got to have a don't laugh at me. But also, I'm going to be offended if you don't like my ideas. And this is, I don't know how the great religions have pulled this one off. But they have, even today, that we mustn't say something because somebody might be offended. All right, I believe in the great spaghetti monster in the sky. And he made me, and he's looking after me all the time. And if things go wrong, he will extend his invisible noodly appendages and help me along.
1 minute, Sue.
What if you tell me that's a silly idea? I'm going to be offended. And everybody's got to not offend me, because it's my religion. So there, so don't offend me. So, other subtle tricks. You'll be a better person. Or the claim that morality comes from God or comes from the religion. That's a very, very powerful one. We want to be good. That we've evolved as a social species to want to be good. We have reciprocal altruism. We want to... I'm almost finished. Stop. We want to be good. We want to be liked. And that's a very powerful trick. But we know that such studies as there are don't show that religious people behave better. We need much more research. But there was a recent study which showed, comparing different developed nations, that the nations with the greater religious belief also had the highest violent crime rates, highest suicide, highest murder, highest teenage pregnancy. Now, it's a correlation, not a cause. But it's not obviously true that people behave better because they're religious. People behave well because there are good reasons why in a species like ours we should cooperate. And we do. So let them not play that trick too heavily. I'm sure you can think up plenty of tricks that are going on in there yourself. But think of it this way. Think of religions, the ones we have now, as honed by all these centuries of evolutionary processes, and you'll see just why they have become as bad as they are today. So no, belief in God is not just a harmless personal lifestyle choice. It is indeed a dangerous delusion.
That was fantastic, Sue. Thank you. Our next speaker, Professor Alastair McGrath at the University of Oxford, Professor of Historical Theology. He's also Senior Research Fellow at the Harris Manchester College in Oxford. His first degree, again from Oxford, was in chemistry, and then his PhD in molecular biophysics. His next degree, also in Oxford, and some bells to confirm that, was in theology. He then went to Cambridge studying divinity and was ordained in 1980. He's been a university lecturer and researcher in theology in Oxford and Vancouver approximately ever since. He's also an author and has particularly written on science and religion. So a book, Scientific Theology, Dawkins' God, Genes, Memes, and the Meaning of Life, and also the Dawkins delusion. So please join me in welcoming our next speaker, the opposer, Professor Alastair McGrath.
Well, thank you very much, and let me say what a huge pleasure and privilege it is to be able to speak to you tonight. I also would like to say how delighted we are that Sue is here, because she's had this accident, and it's just wonderful that she's been able to be with us, and I, for one, am just very, very pleased she's here. If I'd been told tonight, when I was young, that I would be speaking at a debate on atheism, is God a dangerous delusion, I think I wouldn't have been surprised until someone would have told me that I'd be speaking opposing the motion. Because when I was young, growing up in Northern Ireland, I was an atheist. And I have to tell you that there are various kinds of atheists. There is the extremely nice kind of atheist, and then there's a rather different kind of atheist who basically holds that those who believe in God are mad, bad, or sad. And I have to tell you with some shame, I was that kind of atheist. Why was I? Well, I think for two reasons. Number one, I was studying the sciences. And it seemed to me to be as obvious could be, that the sciences disprove God, that the natural sciences eroded the conceptual space once inhabited by God. But more than that, of course, growing up in Northern Ireland with this tension between Protestants and Catholics, again, it seemed very obvious to me that religion simply engendered violence. If there were no Protestants and no Catholics, there would be no violence between Catholics and Protestants. So again, it seemed very straightforward. And I went up to Oxford to study chemistry, really intending to have a career in the natural sciences, and then was somewhat disconcerted to discover, when I went up to Oxford, that actually I began to reappraise my faith as an atheist and come to a very different position. And therefore, for me, the discovery of God at university was life-changing. I found God to be liberating. I found it to bring intellectual depth, far exceeding that than I'd expected to my study for natural sciences. It was an intellectual conversion. There was no way, I think, that I wanted there to be a God. I regarded that as simply being something that would have been a childish delusion, to come back to our theme this evening. But it seemed to me that the evidence really forced me in that direction. And that really began to move me in a whole range of directions, to reappraise things, to think things through in a completely different way. And so I'm very pleased to be able to speak at this debate tonight. And really I want to look at two themes which I think emerge very clearly from the title given to this debate. First of all, is God a delusion? And then secondly, God, whether a delusion or not, is belief in God dangerous? And these seem to me to be two very timely things to talk about. I'd like to move on and begin by speaking about the theme, is God a delusion? For me, belief in God is the most rational thing in the world. It's what happens when you reflect on the way the world is, the way we are. It is something that almost seems to be written into the way the universe is. And writers like Richard Swinburne, C.S. Lewis, and others seem to me to really uncover the rationality of faith. This is not some kind of leap in the dark. This is not about running away from reality. Rather, it's embracing it and saying, this is the way things are. Here's a way of making sense of it. And for me, as someone who's always been interested in the philosophy of science, it seems to me that the inference to the best explanation, which seems to be so deep-rooted in the scientific method, really suggests to us that God might well be the best explanation of what we observe. Now, I don't want to leave you with this impression that I believe in God simply as an idea. For me, God is far more than a simple idea. He is one who transforms, who brings joy, who moves us from biological existence to life in all its fullness. And it seems to me that the existential dimensions of faith really are enormously important here. This is not simply an idea. This is something that really changes life and moves us on to a different way of living and certainly to a different way of thinking. So is this delusional? That seems to me to be a very important point. And certainly, for example, Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion, would argue that it is. There is no God, he argues, but lots of people believe in God, and therefore there must be some reason why people believe in God when it is quite clear that there is no God to believe in. And it seems to me that this may represent a slight confusion about which is the presupposition and which is the conclusion of an argument. But nevertheless, it is helpful, I think, to be able to engage with this. And certainly there is one line of argument which you do find, for example, in Dawkins, but you find it much more widely, which goes like this. You believe in God because you want to. It is what brings you consolation. You do want things to be the way you want them to be, and therefore you invent God as a kind of consolation to see you through life with all its ups and downs. That's an argument that has a respectable pedigree going back to Ludwig Feuerbach in the 1840s, through Marx, through Freud, and indeed with us today in various forms. But I think it is also an argument that needs to be challenged. It needs to be challenged, I think, at two levels. First, I concede without any argument that nothing need be the case, nothing need exist, because that is what we want. We might all want there to be peace in the Middle East. We can want as much as we like, but I'm afraid something needs to be done to actually change that situation. I think that is very, very clear. But, and here's my question, does it therefore follow that because we want something to be true, it cannot be true for that reason? Because the whole Christian vision of human nature is that in some way we have been made in order to relate to God. That, as the Old Testament puts it, God has placed eternity in our hearts. Or as Augustine of Hippo put it in about 386, he wrote as a prayer to God, "You have created us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in you." So maybe there's some kind of homing instinct in human nature to find its way back to God. But there is a point here which I want to stress. All the major studies of the emergence of atheism in Europe from the 18th century onwards make this point very clearly, that atheism became influential because that was precisely what people wanted to be the case. If there is no God, we make the rules. We decide what is right. We are not dictated to by somebody else. Wouldn't it be nice if there is no God? The wish gives rise to the belief, and you can argue, as many have done, that atheism is simply the religious dimension of human autonomy and the quest for absolute freedom in the world. And really the difficulty of this wish fulfillment theory is it cuts each way. It can explain Christianity. It can explain atheism. Personally, I think it explains neither of them very well, but it is a double-edged sword. So might this delusion come about through some other way? Sue, in a number of her books, has talked about the ideas of memes, and certainly she's brought it up again tonight, and it's a very interesting idea. And I want to make it clear that actually my difficulty with memes is not really religious. I mean, if memes do exist, then as far as I'm concerned, memes generate atheism as much as they do religious belief, and therefore it seems to me that they explain everything rather than just religious belief. So I don't find the idea persuasive. It seems to me the real issue here is there scientific warrant for this belief? And I have to say that really I have to depart from Sue at this point and say I simply do not see the science there to make me think that memetics, this science of memes, really stands up to the critical examination which certainly I would look for. It seems to me that memes either explains too much or too little. And therefore, really, it seems to me, it is redundant explanatorily in that we can explain what we observe in other ways. So I don't really find the meme hypothesis very persuasive. There are, I think, some extremely interesting ways we could explore this, but I'm with Pascal Boyer on this, that memes are a very good first attempt to explain the kind of things we see, the patterns of belief. But really, we need to move on and look at different ways of explaining this. If we explain beliefs by memes, all beliefs, then really, it seems to me that actually that applies to atheism, to belief in God, to a whole range of other things that are socially mediated. And actually, I'm not really sure where that takes us in terms of our debate tonight. Simon Conway Morris, in his very interesting book, Life's Solution, published about 4 years ago, Morris is professor of evolutionary paleobiology at Cambridge, argues that memes really don't serve any useful purpose, and in his view, actually, erode the possibility of critical thought. We want to be able to criticize ideas rather than passively receive them, as if somehow we are unable to evaluate these ideas that are coming at us. So is God a delusion? I would say no. I would say that God is a reality, a transformative reality, and one certainly that has really had a major impact on me. Now, we might take this a stage further, and we might then begin to move on and ask, what sort of reasons might one want to give for belief in God? I think we make it absolutely clear that one cannot prove God as one can prove that 2 and 2 make 4. But I also need, I think, to raise the issue that there are many things that each of us here tonight believes to be important. Yet when the chips are done, we know we simply cannot prove them with the certainty that comes with 2 and 2 make 4. I believe passionately that democracy is better than fascism. If you were to say to me, can you prove that empirically? Can you prove that logically? I would have to say, I don't believe I can. But nevertheless, I have every right to believe this as something that seems to me to be the best justified approach, and therefore it makes a huge difference to me. And I think all of you here tonight will be able to identify beliefs, moral, political, ethical, which you know to be vitally important, and yet you also are aware that you really can't prove them. And that is just the way things are. And certainly this is one of the issues that I think we need to explore this evening, the realization that in most areas of life, beliefs that really matter, we may well believe they are justified. That is to say that sufficient reasons may be given for them, but also realizing that they cannot be proved in that strict logical sense. They are justified in the sense we may give reasons for them, good reasons for them, but very often we know that we can't prove them, even though we are very committed to them and they matter profoundly to us. So I move on. Is belief in God, whether delusional or not, something that is dangerous? And certainly, I thought this was the case when I was younger. It was very, very clear to me that atheism was the right way ahead. Get rid of religion, you get rid of religious violence. And again, to someone growing up in Belfast, it was just very obvious to me this was the case. I'm sure you all know the famous story about the Englishman who goes to Belfast one night in the 1980s. Unwisely, he stays out late. And he's coming back to his hotel late at night, and he's confronted by a group of youths with baseball bats. And they force him up against the wall, and they say to him, "Are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic?" Now, the man thinks about this for a few minutes because he realizes that the answer he gives may have no small import on what happened next. And then he has a stroke of absolute genius. "I'm an atheist!" There is a pause. "Are you a Protestant atheist or are you..." But it seems to me that this really is a very serious issue. Does belief in God lead to violence? I think it can do. I want to be very, very clear about that and very, very honest. For me, it is absolutely clear that belief in God can do this. You can look at the Spanish Inquisition. You can give many examples of this, and I concede those. But I want to raise an extremely important point. Are we talking about the center, or are we talking about the fringes? Who is mainstream? Who is normal? And what is way out? And I think really the big question that we need to address here is the place of the fanatic in any worldview, whether religious, anti-religious, political, or anything at all. Let me begin to amplify this. Some of you will have seen Richard Dawkins' program, The Root of All Evil, in which he assembled a rather motley crew of religious people who personally, I think, should have been sectioned under the Mental Health Act. And they were clearly just off the radar screens in terms of their mad ideas. And these were presented as if they were normal. And that is an extremely important point. What is normal? Every community, whether it is people who believe in God, people who oppose belief in God, or whatever, have those at the center and those at the periphery. And it seems to me to be of major importance to make that distinction. It's also important in dealing with violence, because to characterize people who believe in God as if they are intrinsically violent is actually to rob you of one of the main resources of dealing with religious violence, namely those who believe religion is opposed to violence, being able to challenge those who believe violence is justified on their own terms. I think there is a very important point here. Let's look at the history of atheism in the 20th century. Lenin's authorization of the protracted use of violence to suppress religion in the 20s. Stalin's judicious use of firing squads to help atheism, which was languishing a bit from about 1937 to 39. This doesn't look good to me. Now, those of you who are atheists in the audience will quite rightly come back at me and say, well, that's not fair, that's not typical. And you are right. But you must recognize that I and those who believe in God feel precisely the same way when mavericks, fanatics, are presented as if they are normal. It is extremely easy to present the pathological as if it's normal, but it just won't do. Let's look at an example. Many of you will be aware that the United States has gun laws very different from those we have here, and therefore there are these shooting incidents. And last October, there was one in the state of Pennsylvania where a gunman broke into an Amish schoolhouse. Remember, the Amish, very conservative Protestant sect, wear 17th century clothes, drive horse buggies, not cars. And this gunman broke into a schoolhouse and shot dead five schoolgirls. It was a dreadful event. The Amish were absolutely clear. God was disclosed in Jesus. If you want to know what God is like and what God wants, you look at Jesus. Jesus did no violence, but had violence done to him. And the Amish were absolutely clear. There will be no retribution. There will simply be the offering of forgiveness. And the key point is that the cycle of violence was ended before it began. Jesus, for Christians, is of enormous importance. And it raises this fundamental question. What God are we talking about? How do we know what God is actually like? And for Christians, God is disclosed in that little bit of history that we call Jesus of Nazareth. And it's there that we find someone who is as much a challenge to the church and to Christians as to anyone else. Someone who accepts the outsiders. Someone who is willing to go and hold the leper's hand. And above all, someone who utterly eschews violence. That seems to me to be a very powerful critique of anyone who chooses to use violence in God's name. Yes, some Christians do. But I want to say that does not mean they are good Christians for doing so. There is a mechanism for challenge and a mechanism for correction. So let me bring this talk to a close. I welcome this debate. It seems to me to be enormously important to look at the issues raised, both by Sue in her talk and indeed some of her books, by Richard Dawkins, by Sam Harris, by Christopher Hitchens and others. And it seems to me that they really are asking all the right questions. And therefore it seems to me very important to put on the table that while I accept there are many criticisms that can be made and made justly of those who believe in God, falling short of their standards, doing things that are really way out of line, that actually one does need to say maybe the issue here is not so much about people who believe in God, people who don't believe in God, but rather where do fanatics come from and what can we all do to try and stop this happening? That's a question for those of us who do believe in God, but I want to submit to you it's a question for all of us, because atheism has its fanatics as well as religious ones. Politicians, tribal violence, you can think of all this. If you and I feel, as I hope we all do, that the world is such a dangerous place that we want to try and discredit fanatics and minimize their popular appeal, then I say we need to recognize fanaticism is not something unique to religion. It's something deeply embedded in human nature. It's a problem for all of us. And I believe together we can do something about it, despite this funny noise that's coming from the beeper. Thank you very much.
To reply.
Oh,
and I'll set that again. And I'm sure that in her reply, she's going to include something about scientific evidence for her belief in memes. I thought that was quite brave of you, calling it a belief. There we go.
Thank you. Have you started it?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Well, I'm asking the right questions. Presumably, I'm giving all the wrong answers. We do agree about quite a lot of things. Alistair has quite rightly marked out some of those, and I will absolutely concede some of the things he said about the dangers of fanatical belief of all sorts, the fact that there have been horrible atheist dictatorships, that terrible things are done in other names than religion. I'm sure there's plenty there that we agree on. But let me pick up some of the things where I think I don't quite understand what Alistair was trying to say, and some which I disagree about. This argument about do people believe things because they want to, I was sort of expecting it to come to some kind of a conclusion. Yes, I quite agree with Alistair. Just because you want something to be true doesn't prove whether it is or it's not. I was kind of wondering whether he was going along the lines of, well, it kind of helps that he really didn't want it to be true, and then he changed his mind. This is a very familiar one to me, because I started out my academic life 35 years ago believing in the paranormal passionately and desperately. I was going to prove to all my lecturers and all those close-minded scientists out there that there's more in heaven and earth than in your philosophy, and telepathy really exists, and life after death and near-death experiences. And I found the evidence just wasn't there, and I had to change my mind. So I got picked up by the psychop lot, the skeptics lot, as their kind of mascot, because I was this wonderful thing who'd changed her mind and gone round to the other side, which is much more powerful than just the ordinary one who's always been skeptical. And you get much the same sort of arguments here. I don't think Alistair was really going there, but it was kind of left hanging. Is there just nothing to be said about whether we want it to be true? I think it is important that we want to have those comforts, and it really does help us understand what was going on. This also is relevant to the memes argument. Now, I can't, in 7 minutes, do a grand defense of the theory of memes, but I would say this. If it doesn't lead to any predictions, if it doesn't help us understand cultural evolution better than competing theories in cultural evolution, such as several different versions of gene culture co-evolution theory, then it's not much use and we should throw it out. But the vision of memetics is different from the vision of those other theories. Those other cultural evolution theories fundamentally all come down to culture on a leash, as Wilson puts it. That in the end, the replicator that drives everything on this planet and human life is the gene. And for all the fact that things may be maladaptive for genes, in the end, the genes have control. The vision for memetics is that once human beings began to be able to imitate, to copy, then they began a new copying and selection, copying, selection, copying, selection process, which is an evolutionary process in its own right, not, as Dawkins put it in the very beginning, not necessarily subservient to the old. And that everything we see around us here is evolving, using us as its copying machinery. That's what we are. We're the meme machines. We're the copying machinery. It's all up and running. It's going faster and faster, and our role is rapidly diminishing, as we see with the internet, as we see with the destruction of a climate. The memes are extracting the oil from the ground and using us in the process. That's the vision. Now, does that translate into something relevant here today? Well, where it would do is, can we test the kind of ideas I put forward about how religions actually evolved? Can we see, for example, that perhaps geographical isolation caused kind of island effects, as it does in biology, with religions taking hold in different ways because of different kinds of environments, different sorts of human brains, perhaps, genetically evolved to be slightly different and like different memes, attract different kinds of religious ideas. There's all sorts of ways in which that could be tested, and it will fail or it will succeed, be useful or not. And I'm used to having to change my mind in the face of the evidence. I can do it again if I have to. Yeah, you can expect me up here in 10 years going, oh, I used to be a mimeticist. We shall see. I want to talk about something a bit deeper. Alistair talked about, I'm old and I need glasses and I can't read my writing. God as the one who transforms, brings joy and life in all its fullness. Now that sounds important to him, sounds important to me. Something that can, I mean, hey, you know, we're so busy in life doing all kinds of unimportant stuff, but you know, don't we all have somewhere deep down thoughts, feelings about what is it to be human? What really matters? Things in our life like falling off a horse and spending weeks in the BRI and thinking, well, I'm lucky I didn't break my back and look at all those other poor people. And, you know, things that make you, or amazing mystical experiences. I've had plenty of mystical experiences. Things like the sense of everything falling away and entering into oneness, in which you just are everything and self is gone. Experiences of apparently being transported, these kinds of things, they're natural to human beings. Now, for Alistair, these kinds of things, joy, that kind of, you know, the sort of amazing joy that appears out of nowhere. I love that title of C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy. And then he gets into all this God stuff. But, you know, that sort of real extraordinary deep joy of not happiness, not being pleased about something, but that's, you know, wow. But it doesn't have anything. Why should it have anything to do with God? You know, if we can understand our human nature and how these things are possible, surely we can enrich our lives as human beings and our relationships with other people. It doesn't have to have anything to do with God. Science has been pretty damn slow to get to this, and for understandable reasons, and I hope it will. In fact, I'm trying to help it do so. But it should be able to do so. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with God. And finally, nor, I think, need Jesus. Now, that sounds very odd, perhaps. But the moving stories that Alistair tells about the impact of the example set by something, and we don't really know what he did. We don't really know. But let us suppose that he really was that wonderful and set that fantastic nonviolent example. That example should stand to all of us to try to be better. Why do we want to be better? Well, maybe we can't justify that and have to take it on faith, but maybe there's a biological reason, as I hinted at before, why we actually want to be good. And if we do want to be good, then we will take those examples and we don't need to have God to justify why we want to be good.
And back to Alistair.
Well, thank you very much. And let me thank Sue for both her talks. And I must apologize both to her and also to you because she put forward a lot of very interesting ideas. And I'm just not going to have time to interact with all of them in this brief response. But if I could pick up some of the themes that she mentioned. I was very taken by the way in which she referred to Sam Harris's book on faith, meaning something which is based on inadequate evidence, something which is not adequately justified by what you observe, and making the point this is corrosive. And I think I do want to challenge that. I think there is a very interesting question here about why people believe certain things, knowing they can't prove them, but nonetheless believing this is the best way of making sense of them. There is no intellectual disparity between saying, I really think this is right, and although the evidence is not conclusive, it's good enough for me, and being able to say that is absolutely right. I think that it's a very important point for all of us. And as Sue and I both have been talking a lot about the sciences tonight, I want to really focus on that because it seems to me to be enormously important. I'd like to pick up some themes, if I may, from a very interesting book by Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine back in the 60s, which he called The Limits of Science. Now, it's a wonderful book, and it raises the following question. For Medawar, the sciences are wonderful in that they're able to examine this material world, to establish correlations, to be able to show how there are relationships between various entities and forces in the material world. But he then goes on, and he says, when it comes to questions of meaning or value, then actually science isn't going to help us very much. Now, what he's saying is provocative, but I think it's very significant. For example, he gives what Karl Popper called the ultimate questions. What is the point of life being one of those? I'd want to say to you, I don't think science can answer that question. But I want also to say that I think for every one of you here tonight, it's a rather important question. And I think all of you will have your own answers to that question. And you will not be able to prove it scientifically or rationally, but you will nevertheless say, I think I've got an answer, and it's one that shapes the way I live and the way in which I think. I want to say I do not think that that means you have in any way run away from the evidence. It's simply realizing the limitations that when you start looking at things like 2 and 2 make 4, and when you move on to questions like, what is the meaning of life, you're playing a completely different ball game. And one of the things that I find so disappointing in Sam Harris's book was this really 19th century positivist view, like W. K. Clifford, you know, that you only believe those things which can absolutely be proved, but there are many beyond those which we believe to be right, and we certainly believe to be important. Now, Sue talked quite a lot about memes, and again, she said many things, some of which actually I agree with. She says, for example, that we are the copying machines. And I think actually I can agree with that, that I see exactly what she means. She's helping us to understand how ideas spread. But I would want to come back and say there is nevertheless a significant debate, not so much of how ideas are transmitted, but what their evidential basis is. And certainly when I was young, I saw myself as being a free thinker. I was going wherever the evidence took me. And for me, the conclusion I came to was that believing in God made far more sense of things than anything else. And I would defend that, not so much in terms of I picked this idea up from someone, but rather that this seemed to me to be absolutely the best way of thinking of things. I think, for example, of a quote from C.S. Lewis that seems to me to express this idea better than I could. I believe in Christianity, he wrote, as I believe the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And we see there this very significant idea, which I think plays a major role in philosophy of science, which is how capable is a theory of actually engaging with what is observed? Is it good at empirical fit, if I can use the jargon? And again, it seems to me that understanding how ideas are spread is a very interesting point, but we keep coming back to this point, what is their evidential basis? And really, for me, the evidential basis of belief in God seemed to me to be extremely powerful. But it's not good enough. I mean, we need also to have something that's more than just an idea. And I think, for example, of Roy Baumeister's very famous book, The Meanings of Life, in which he makes the point that for any theory to impact on life, it needs to talk about value, agency, purpose. And immediately that moves us beyond the strict domain of the scientific. There are many scientists who would want to critique Christianity, but it is immensely important to realize there are many who would say their faith leads them in precisely that direction. Last year, for example, Francis Collins published his book, The Language of God. Writing as the director of the Human Genome Project, he simply made the point that as an atheist who'd become a Christian, he found his faith gave sense-making capacity to the whole scientific enterprise and also gave him the motivation that really enabled him to engage with nature at that deep level. Now, again, you may want to challenge that, but I think it's extremely important to see that for many, Religious belief does not run away from the evidence, but actually forces you to engage with it in far greater depth. And I would certainly echo some of Sue's points. I think, for example, we are both agreed for the need for intellectual rigor, for the need, no means for deciding what is ethical. Now, again, you may wish to challenge him at that point. But if he is right, then there's a very interesting question. How do we try and ascertain that religious belief, belief in God, is actually bad for people, as Freud said all those years ago when he dismissed it as being some sort of pathology? But it seems to me that really the evidence, if anything, points in the direction that religious conviction, when personally adopted and not socially imposed, actually has the capacity to bring stability, to actually give purpose. And while I want to come back to the question of its truth, there can be no doubt that it works. And in our postmodern age, one of the key criteria for a worldview is this: does this actually work? Thank you very much.
Fabulous. Thank you both enormously. And interesting to be using one of Richard Dawkins' argument at the end there. Now, the process for asking questions, if you'll just bear with me, is that we're going to ask you, if you want to ask a question, to queue up at the front. And there's a microphone on the left for questions that are going to go to Sue, and a microphone on the right for questions to Alistair. If you've got a general comment or a question for them both, take your pick. And I would encourage you, if you're way up there at the top and you want to ask a question, just come down the stairs and come to the front as well. Likewise, you behind. I don't want anybody to feel excluded because of where they're sitting. So, audience, over to you. If you'd like to start to queue up, left for Sue, right for Alistair, and the microphones are just moving gently forward to bring them slightly closer to you. And we're just being mown down by the people rushing to the front. If there's more than a few questions, which I imagine there will be, questions or comments, I might take a few at the same time.
I would like to ask both, please, and thank you so much for what you both told us. Who moved the stone in Jesus' tomb? Has the resurrection ever been satisfactorily disproved? That is my question. Thank you.
Right, and a question for Sue.
Sue was saying that she doesn't really believe in religion, but yet why does she follow Zen?
Great. Sue, do you want to kick us off with why do you follow Zen?
Yes, I'm not. Does this work? I'm not a Buddhist. I won't take on the things they write in their books. I won't believe things because they say so. But a long time ago, I discovered I like Zen because it's a very clean, crisp, clear system. Sit down, shut up, watch the mind. And so I have, they might be disapproving of me, adopted that method as a way of understanding the mind. And the effects over 30 years I've been doing it, quite interesting. That's the reason. Somehow or another, I just keep doing it. It's hard work, but it seems worthwhile to spend a little while every morning sitting down and calming the mind and having a look what it's actually like.
And Sue, do you want to add anything about has resurrection ever been disproved?
Well, frankly, all those years as a parapsychologist, painstaking looking into eyewitness testimony and claims of paranormal events and so on, that always turn out either there just isn't enough evidence or you finally find out who cheated or who made it up in the end, leave me not knowing.
Alistair, would you like to pick up
certainly.
Who moved
well,
the stone?
For me, I think that's a very important question. I think you may be hinting at Frank Morrison's book, Who Moved the Stone. But certainly, for me, the question of the resurrection is not just an item on its own. It's part of a web of ideas that really come together to constitute the Christian way of looking at things. And for me, clearly the points Sue's made are important. Is this simply a fraud? Is this just some kind of mass delusion? And again, it's very interesting to note how the New Testament itself takes the view that here is something that is open to challenge, but also is open to critical evaluation. Paul, for example, is absolutely clear. Look, there's something I believe to be right, and he lists all these people who he believes will come in his support. And again, as I read, for example, the Acts of the Apostles, you note that the very interesting debate between Christians and Jews that you find in Acts chapter 2 is not really about the actuality of the resurrection. It's what on earth does this mean? And again, you'll find modern Jews like Pinchas Lapid making a very similar point. Something very odd is going on here. What is its interpretation? And in many ways, I think the key issue is what is the interpretation of the resurrection? And of course, if I had time, so I could actually preach a sermon rather than just get going like this, I want to talk about the importance of that for our understanding of who Jesus is, but also its general impact, for example, on
this
understanding
isn't another 7
of human
minutes. Forgive
nature
me.
And destiny. And I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Over there.
Hi, hello. My question's for Professor McGrath. It's actually not my question. It's a Christopher Hitchens question, but I'd like it sort of answered, really. It's that way before you get to questions about the resurrection and the miraculous, you have to accept, if you believe in the Judeo-Christian God, or that... he was inactive in human affairs for a very long time, that the human race, which has been around for hundreds of thousands of years, really only the interaction between God and the human race starts 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. So to sort of use Christopher Hitchens' phrase, did he just sit cross-armed, watching countless generations of humans annihilate each other, rape each other, and die of preventable diseases, including things that presumably God designed himself. How do you get around that way before you start talking about Jesus or the burning bush or any of the rest of it? Thank you.
We'll hold that question and go over to one from Sue.
Hi. I'm interested in how you can group Christianity in with the other religions so readily. If you look at the example of Jesus and read the Bible and what the regulations are, well, not regulations, but people, it clearly says you don't kill people. It's obvious that is not right, and that the people who are doing that are off on one. Whereas possibly other religions, you group in with extremism and Muslims, in with that as well. I'm interested in how you can do that. Christianity is not in the danger with things like Islam, is that the only way you get to heaven in this instance is by your own deeds. And since Islam says that if you die trying to kill non-Muslims, then you'll get to heaven, then that's a good shortcut. But this is very different from Christianity.
Okay, and just one more from the other side for Alistair.
Well, I'd actually like, if it's within the rules, to ask a question of the audience.
Of course.
I'd like to know whether the following idea is a non-starter or whether it's worth taking seriously. I would say that both speakers are 95% right. The debate's presented as an either-or. But I would say that Sue is right in that if you look at the history of religion, there's a lot of delusion and a lot of danger. But I think Alistair's right that there is a God, perhaps not quite as personal as the standard Christian God, and that the history of religion is a struggle towards that truth. So I'd like to ask people if they think that's an idea worth taking seriously or whether it's a non-starter.
Okay, so put up your hands if you think that both speakers were 95% right, that there's lots of delusion and danger in religion, but there is a God and it involves an ongoing struggle. Hands up if you agree with that. Oh, right. So that's about about a quarter. Hands up if you disagree. Quite a lot more. That's more like a half or two-thirds. Great, thank you very much for that. Okay, Alistair, what was God doing then before the resurrection? Was he
well,
just sitting around?
I think the question went back further than that, actually. The question Christopher Hitchens is asking, and certainly we debated this in Washington recently, was, in effect, where was God before Abraham, if I can put it very simply like that. And of course, the issue here is that of written records, that in effect the Old Testament goes back a long way, but of course it doesn't go back all that way. So what we have is, for Christians, what is a normative record of what God has done, which goes back to the calling of Abraham, but behind that we just don't have records. Now, if you look at a book published recently by a man called Wenzel van Heusting of Princeton, one of the things he's doing is looking at the spirituality of ancient cave art. And he goes back to caves that are thought to go back 20,000 years. And his argument in this book is that in some way one can discern an emerging spiritual sense in the themes that are there in those paintings. Now, I mean, obviously, the question we're asking basically is, on the basis of a Christian understanding of God, was God active before Abraham? And I would certainly want to say he was, that, in effect, this is the way God is, but I don't have the evidence to back this up because I don't have the written text going back that far. And therefore, what I'd want to say is that, from the Christian perspective, God is, as he always has been, profoundly concerned about human nature. And that's one of the reasons why, for Christians, the idea of the incarnation is just so important, because this talks about God choosing to enter into a suffering world, a world of death, and actually going through that himself. And it's a very powerful affirmation of the commitment of God to his creation, and also it really tries to bring out this idea that God cares for humanity so much, he comes to where we are in order to meet us and offer that transformation. So that's how I'd want to begin to answer that question.
I want to fight back, and I'm not allowed in the rules. He comes to me. Oh.
You can have a brief fight, but
no,
I'm going
right,
to urge our speakers
right.
to be briefer, because there's quite a lot of questions. But if you want to fight back, you can. But you, then
no,
this...
it's all right. That'll do. Could I please ask you to move that microphone over there a bit, because I want to be able to see who is asking. Thank you. Lovely. Right. Why am I lumping together? Well, in a sense, I could say that you're kind of make special pleading for Christianity. I'm sure we've got some Muslims here. I think some Muslims would say they pick all the nice bits and say that you hear it often enough. Heard just one yesterday on the radio, picking the nice bits from Islam and saying Islam is a peace-loving religion. Yeah, we know the Quran is horrible and full of ghastly things, but many individual Muslims would defend their faith in the same way and take the nice bits and say that. But in another way, I wasn't lumping them together as being the same at all, although I was saying that they all have their dangers. I was lumping them together in the sense of saying we can understand this great bush of possibilities of how they evolved. We can understand them all as having evolved through the same kind of selection process. They've ended up very different. They've ended up with different tricks that make them work because they've passed through different kinds of people in different parts of the world. But that's the only extent to which I was intending to lump them together.
Great, thank you. Des?
And this question for Sue. You describe how mimetics helps us to understand the sort of the tree of knowledge of ideas, and then somehow it seems to me, I'm a boy, what you might call a religious person, so I'll lay my cards on the table, but it seems to me that you kind of somehow pick out religion as something somehow separate or different from ideas generally, as if it warrants special merit compared to other things. So I would kind of be happier with your reasoning if you included atheism or if you included postmodernism or the whole gamut of ideas within this, and rather than giving religion a special place, actually say, well, all of these are part of the kind of the struggle of ideas in humanity, and let's just have a look at this and maybe develop a science of it, but let's not single out religion particularly. I'm just questioning, why is it that religion's got you so bothered as opposed to other things like postmodernism or modernism or anything else?
Oh, they get me bothered as well. It's got me so bothered because I was asked to speak at a debate on God a dangerous delusion.
Yeah. I can see that, obviously, but it is something. It is something that it seems to be people like Dawkins and maybe I'd be right in thinking that you are bothered.
It's still a good question. Let's take postmodernism. I think the same thing is happening to postmodernism. There's a wonderful book by Brickmont and Sokal. I don't know if you know about this story, but Sokal, who is a famous physicist, did the most amazing, pulled off the most amazing trick. He said he'd give himself 3 months. If you tried to learn from scratch quantum mechanics and modern physics in 3 months, you wouldn't get very far. Certainly not if you weren't already a brilliant mathematician. But he took 3 months and immersed himself in all the postmodern stuff. And then he wrote the most amazing spoof. He took all the kind of quantum mechanics words and twisted them around in kind of, you know, Lacan and sort of, you know, Derrida sort of way. And his paper got, like, made the important leading article in the most famous journal called Text, and then he pulled the rug, you know? That's what should happen to memes, that people assess them on their truth value and so on. Now, the same with science. But the difference here is this. I would say this in general about memes. Why do certain memes survive? They survive because they manage to get people to copy them. Why do they do that? Sometimes they do it because they're true or useful or beautiful or have some kind of benefit to people. And sometimes they do it by trickery and by pretending to be true and useful and beautiful and so on. Science has right within it the mechanisms, not perfect, yeah, there are loads of problems, yeah, peer review doesn't always work, blah, 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 but it has within it the mechanisms for saying, well, we'll do the experiment. We'll check it against the real world. And that's why, by and large, it's the truth value. Whereas religions have completely different ideas, and so does postmodernism. So they're all memes, they're all memeplexes, but they use different ways to survive.
But isn't it interesting how... sorry, I better not...
Yes, 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 and then...
Your opponent would...
Your opponent would
say
like
that
he's gagging
would,
to
the,
say
the scientific method
but
would actually
please be brief.
Come to the opposite conclusion.
I mean, I'm intrigued. Sue talked about memes managing to get people to copy them, and that implies activity, or they trick people. That implies personality. I mean, I find this attribution of agency to memes when they're clearly passive is really quite puzzling. But
it's shorthand to say the ones that manage to trick them succeed and spread and get copied, and the ones that don't. The shorthand is they try to trick them, whatever. If I can't expand it into the longhand, I shouldn't be saying it. I hope I always can. You can try and catch me out.
Thank you.
Again, mine's a question which I hope both speakers can address. And it's this one. We all have, just about everybody here, hundreds of people, we all know what God is in our own way. But if we hadn't been told in the beginning of our lives and our education and so on, how many of us would have come up with the idea on our own?
Great, thanks. Thank you. That's a great question. Can we hold that one, though, and we'll take one from over here as well.
Thank you. Aside from the rather emotive arguments that you've put forward, one of the main thrusts seems to be the argument with regard to institutionalized religion. You yourself said that if 40% of the population pray, it's a far smaller proportion that actually follow some form of institutionalized religion. Therefore, if you're going to go on a majority view, it seems to be that that God is dangerous to a very small proportion of the of society. Going on from that, if then altruistic behaviors, which are institutionalized by any form of God, are a beneficial thing. As you yourself said, altruistic attitudes and actions within a social group are beneficial. It seems then that any God in a non-institutionalized form is going to promote altruistic attitudes, which are therefore beneficial. You seem to have entirely contradicted yourself.
Sue, would you like to try take that?
Oh, thank you. Well, before I forget it, yes,
yeah, exactly.
Because it's quite complicated.
It's quite
Stay
quite
there,
complicated.
Because it's much easier to answer when I can actually see you. And remember what you said. I think you're saying that I contradicted myself because I said something like, if a few people believe it doesn't really do any harm, it's only when loads and loads do. And actually, I'm wrong in this society because really very few get into the institutional religions and most don't. Yes, it does sound like a contradiction on the surface. But what I was... And maybe you've completely caught me out here, but I don't think so, because what I'm trying to say is that when enough get together to give those institutional religions power, that's when the danger begins. And there's no question that even though the people who go to the mosques, the people who go to the synagogues and churches are very small, their influence is hugely disproportionate. We have these ghastly things happening where, you know, the Danish cartoons, the people bending over backwards to not offend people. The whole question of faith schools, I mean, I think faith schools are one of the most divisive, you know, they weren't doing that much harm, fizzling gently out out, you know, during our lifetimes, but suddenly it's a big issue. Very, very divisive, keeping kids apart from kids of other religions. These things have a disproportionate, dangerous and unpleasant effect on society, even though the numbers of people are actually relatively small. It's a good point, and I'll think about it some more. That's as far as I can get with the answer for now.
Thank you, and thank you for summarising the question again for us. Now, both of you...
hang on, what about this question?
Yes, I know, oh. I know. He's still standing there waiting, which is great. We all know what God is, maybe. If we weren't told in the first place, would we have come up with the idea of God?
Well, I think the answer is yes. And I think there are very substantial number of psychological studies that show that. For example... Justin Barrett's recent book, you know, Why Would Anyone Believe in God, which adopts a cognitive science approach. What I think, I mean, it's a very natural belief. Where I think it gets interesting is when you start bringing specificity to this. In other words, when you say not just a generic idea of God, but a God who is like this, where does that come from? And again, certainly if you look at Christianity, I mean, there's the whole witness of Israel, but then there's also the modulation of that in the life and death of Jesus, where you see that as having a very significant impact on shaping what God is like. So in terms of, you know, people believing in God, but in a sort of rather generic sense, you know, I mean, for example, Dennis Hayes' recent book, Something There, I think he's arguing something like 70% of the British population have this sense of a transcendent something, which they might call God, but it's extremely vague. For me, the really interesting question is how you become specific, how you say, we think we can say God is like this, rather than that. And that, of course, begins to bring into play the whole question of how specific ideas of God are transmitted and developed and indeed justified. So I think God in general is quite easy. The specific forms of belief in God, I think, are much more complex and interesting. And that would involve, I think, looking at transmission of ideas and also trying to validate them.
Very interesting question and very interesting answer from Alistair too. Let me take a different tack on it. I'm thinking while you were both talking there about how can we find out? And yeah, what about scientists thinking these big questions, you know, why is there something rather than nothing and so on? But then I'm thinking about some of the evidence we actually have from little children and how they develop, and also from less developed societies and the kinds of beliefs that they have. And one absolutely fundamental development in early childhood is the tendency to attribute agency to things that move. There are studies of the simplest possible thing, you know, two blobs moving on a screen, and one blob goes forward and catches this one and bumps it, and that one's chasing that one. It's kind of agency. And or for toys playing, the tendency to take a toy and think that it's behind it, it has to adopt the intentional stance, to believe that a little rag doll has desires and beliefs and so on, is absolutely intrinsic to childhood development, which fits very well with what we know of many simple societies and also in far back in history of belief in animism, belief in nature spirits and so on. So that seems to me to be a more natural thing that we adopt because of the way our minds have evolved, our brains have evolved. And I'm wondering, is it a natural leap from that to the kind of big nature spirit, the big one? Because if you think, well, you know, that little blob there did that and that tree did this, but what about the whole thing? Oh, well, maybe there's an agency there. Possibly it is natural, but I'd want a lot more research of that kind and kinds I can't immediately think up to really answer your question.
Brilliant question. Thank you very much. And interesting as well, because even as adults, we can apply agency to memes, can't we?
yes, yeah, good point.
Over here.
When you first proposed or began to propose the motion, you immediately qualified the kind of God you were talking about. And it seems to me that it is only fair to ask, have you really spoken to the motion?
If I were to ask, is the scientist's God dangerous, I would say what I said, no. I think that would be addressing the motion. I hope I did. I addressed it by saying, well, this kind of God, which is quite common, is not dangerous. I think it's not dangerous. I can't prove it. I don't know research that addresses it. But it doesn't seem to me to be so. One issue here would be, can I really carve off one sort of God from the other? I think so. I think very different kind of people believe or use the word God, and then when you really tackle on them, like Einstein, for example, when you tackle them, yeah, but I don't mean that sort of intervention. I don't mean somebody you pray to. I don't mean that. I just mean it's a convenient word for. So I think it is fair to divide it up that way, and yes, I think I did address the motion.
Thank you.
Anyone want to say I didn't?
Should we have a vote on that, Sue? Or should we move on?
Let's move on.
We'll move on. Go ahead.
Please forgive me, Professor Groff, if I've misinterpreted you. There are two things that you said. One was that belief in God seems to be the most rational thing to believe in, and secondly, that you can't prove 2 plus 2 equals 4. To the latter point, perhaps you could consult Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica, but for the first point, I'm curious to know where you stand on the notion of the of a rational theology in contrast to natural theology, insofar as if we assume that the greatest certainties we can have are deductive truths, how much better a resource is a prioristic reasoning to discerning about the nature of God compared to, say, revelation, where there are empirical matters which are contingent and non-necessary?
Well, I'm intrigued by your question. Certainly, you and I read Russell in very different ways, I think I have to say. And I would put you to you Wittgenstein's critique of Russell, which amounts to simply a series of tautologies, which seems to me to be an extremely important point to make, because a tautology has no external referent. It's simply an internally consistent system, which may have no bearing on the way things are. But anyway, going back to the second point you made, which I think is a very good question, and actually it deserves a really long answer, but we haven't time for that. But I'm going to try and just...
Which you weren't
going to do. I'm going to hit the high points very, very briefly. I mean, yes, I mean, deductive proofs do have far greater certainty than, let's say, inferential ones. But the real issue is that, for example, when you're engaging with nature, for example, and trying to work out what is going on here, deduction isn't an option. You are dealing with something that is observed, and therefore the issue is inference. The inference is what is the best way of making sense of this, and you're unable to use deduction unless you feel that you can deduce, you can infer from nature a series of propositions which may then act as the basis of further deduction. So I think really, I mean, as someone who used to be a scientist and still takes that very, very seriously, I would say that the inferential success of the sciences actually is a very good indicator that even though it may be less robust than deduction, nonetheless, it actually, I think, gets us quite a long way down the line. So I personally am quite happy to live with that tension, even though I can see the point you're making.
Thank you. Next.
What sort of evidence would convince you that the Christian God did exist?
Ah, yes, I've laid myself on the line as being influenced more by evidence than not evidence. I would have thought that there isn't any answer to that. Pardon? Christianity doesn't make that sort of a claim. I suppose the only evidence that would convince me would be if I said, right, if you're up there now, smite me dead now, or throw me off a horse now, you know.
Right now.
Yeah, you've got to make the horse first. Bring me a horse and then throw me off again, and it did. Well, I'd be convinced. Also, I'd be convinced if, and I just take this from everything I know and all the work and research I've done and everything I understand about the nature of self and consciousness, awareness and everything else to be impossible, but let's suppose I'm wrong, that I, next time I fall off the horse and get infected with Staphylococcus, whatever it is, and I'm lying there in hospital and I die, that, ooh, there comes a pearly gate. And not only a pearly gate made in my imagination as the near-death experience unfolds and I go through the tunnel and everything else, but it carries on. And I go through the pearly gate. And, wow, there really is a heaven. Then I'd be convinced, but I wouldn't be able to come back and tell anyone about
it. Quite an assumption. It'd be a pearly gate, Sue.
Well, whatever it's supposed to be. Those are the only two that I can think of that would convince me.
Professor McGrath might respond to that.
Well, I would want to say that, very briefly, I'd want to say I look at the way the world is, the ordering of the world. I'd want to look at my own personal experience. I'd look at deductive arguments for God's existence. I'd also, as a Christian, want to look at what is going on in the New Testament, what the best explanation for that is. Key thing, it's not one single piece of evidence. It's a web of interlocking beliefs, which seem to me to give the best possible explanation and the best way of looking at things.
Thank you.
Professor McGrath, with, I think, characteristic generosity, you played the postmodern card by saying what works is in some measure okay. But would you really agree that your religion is only as good or as true as many others? Or would you claim that in some basic way it is more true and better than other religions? And if that is so, would you agree with your own scriptures that those who willfully refuse to believe in your God will ultimately be damned to divine punishment? If the answer to the last two is right, and yes, then your generosity is hollow.
Well, well, thank you for that question. Yes, I do believe in being generous, because for me the key thing is we must go where the evidence takes us. And for that reason, for example, I think it's very important to draw a distinction between something that may be true and something that is real. And that seems to me to be an enormously important point to make. And really, I think towards the beginning I was saying I believe this to be real rather than just true. And then you move on from this to draw this extraordinary conclusion that although you don't know me at all, you feel able to attribute to me personally this view that those who disagree with me are going to hell for that reason. I have to say so. That is a monumental leap of judgment, which I must, with great respect, challenge. Let me tell you what I think. I believe in a God. We all believe in our own ideas of God. I believe in a God who I see in the face of Jesus Christ, one who loves us passionately and says, "Sir, I love you and would love you to come to me." But you don't have to. It's up to you to make that decision. What happens next, I don't know. But for me, this willingness of God to love, this willingness of God to invite, this willingness of God to approach us is immensely important.
You're a good man.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks. A couple of quick points. I don't need a request. I don't need an answer, so it'll be shorter because of that. I was provoked by the audience putting their hands up, and I know how people putting their hands up, if a lot do it, people tend to follow. So I'm going to suggest that the audience give them permission, remind them that they can abstain, because in this particular case, I really favour Sue, but unfortunately, she has expressed faith in the God of science, and blind faith as well, because she's not actually stating the evidence she would accept. The real question is, what is the most responsible? Sue Blackmore believes in memes. I do as well. They do work in the world. They are powerful things. So what is the most responsible position to take? And I would say that it's not the which is the most dangerous delusion, but which is the most dangerous reaction to that delusion. And I think it's the reaction of the so-called scientists, in particular, scientist-based society, particularly in America when it's supported by the religion, reacting against the reaction to the God delusion. So the most responsible one is to be as open as possible, not to close it down, and unfortunately this motion does. It's an either-or motion. And although Professor McGrath tried to avoid the either-or motion, all credit to him to that, it is an either-or motion, and it's that either-or, black and white, yes, no, my side, your side, that's the problem. So in responsibility terms, we should abstain.
That's the point of debates like this, to be like, hey, I love debates like this. In most of our life, yeah, we have to be shades of grey, we have to be, and hey, if you're a parapsychologist, you've got to be open-minded, like to the point I couldn't stand it anymore after 30 years. It's really hard work being open-minded. It's important. But hey, this is a great format. You take an idea, you push people to the limits in both directions. It's fun, it works, we enjoy it. Let's not apply it to all the rest of our life, no.
Actually, I've got certain sympathy. I think we can that very, very polarized debates can do damage. But I actually think tonight it's been remarkably exploring of the grey territory. And not to describe Sue as open, well, both our speakers, when I think they've conceded on different territories. Well, that's not what I've come away with a feeling of, but thank you very much. We'll take another one from this side, since there's more on this side.
Thank you very much. I really liked your evolution argument, how religions evolved, but doesn't that actually show that religion is not a harmful delusion? It's actually beneficial, because certainly a religion has come across a profound idea which has been which helps many people, which may even be inspired by the divine, is more likely to survive one which is propagated by trickery, because surely people are going to propagate a religion of belief which is profound to them, rather than for some rare urge to trick others, which I find personally kind of rare. So
it's an important question in the sense that if you take memetics in an open-minded way and ask the question, why did these memes survive, which I was trying to do, but actually probably, for the sake of this today's argument, I was pushing it in a particular direction rather hard. But as I've said in answer to a previous question, memes can survive for many reasons. A lot of memes, perhaps most memes that are with us in this world today, are here because they're good for us in some way. Because as meme machines, we've got to try and pick the true and the beautiful and the useful. Look at this fabulous hall. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? And you know, most of us in our lives are surrounded by things that are useful or true or beautiful or whatever. But there are also the tricks. Now, we need to find out in each case which they are. It is perfectly possible that God exists. Well, I don't really think so, but because I can't think what it is. But you know, it's possible that there are truths in there, and that the reason that these religions survived are because of those truths. And actually, I think those truths are more not to do with the existence of a supreme being, but to do with mystical experiences, experiences of oneness with the universe, natural experiences of communion with others, these kinds of things are part of what helped the religion spread. And those are intrinsically good reasons why. But mixed in are these tricks. And I hope by explaining how some of the tricks work, I have exposed possibly why they've ended up being dangerous. And after all, that's what I was trying to do here, was to pick out the dangers and explain what they are.
Thank you.
Professor McGrath, you, I think, in reaction to Sue talking about memes and memetics, talked about we all like to be critical of ideas. Now, the dangerous thing I find with religion is when it comes to the indoctrination of children on a mass scale into religion. I find it quite damaging. I mean, I've had friends that have had a very damaging childhood because of Jehovah's Witness parents, and because they didn't want to be religious. Now, I'm sure you'll agree that we all should have that choice. The other thing you mentioned was about fanatics, and I agree that probably 90% of religious people are not dangerous, and they do not act in dangerous ways. But they do seem to support fanatics. We have fanatics in power, fanatical religious figures in power. Now, the people that support those people are not fanatical, but they give support to those fanatics. And I'd just like to hear your views on that.
Yes, well, I think you've raised two very good questions, and certainly I can, you know, sympathise immediately with the first point you made about your friend. I mean, I think that is really a cause for concern. And I would want to say that there is a real issue here about having things rammed down your throat. And certainly I react very strongly against that, as I'm sure you do as well. There's a very important debate here to be had about how we go about teaching what religions actually are and trying to maintain a critical perspective. I think that is really important. And again, paradoxically, I think one of the things about Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, I think it really emphasizes the importance of good religious education. Let's get out on the table what these are really like so we can actually talk about these. Your second point, I think, is also really a very good one. I mean, do you want to amplify it a little bit? Because I'm sure many in the audience will have resonated with it.
sorry, I've almost lost my train of thought.
Religion seems to support fanatics.
It does, so, yes. I mean, the obvious fanatic that's in the press all the time is Mr. George Bush.
Yes.
He's a Christian fundamentalist. But his supporting body, I wouldn't, I mean, they're not themselves.
I think, you know, this is again, a real issue. And again, if you read Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, he will say that the moderates actually are guilty of doing this. And the real issue here is not just to do with religion, it's to do with any community where there are fanatics who actually gain support from it. And certainly, I can remember when I was living in Ireland, coming to Oxford, you know, every time I crossed the water, I come in from Liverpool, I would be stopped by the police regularly. Why? Because I was Irish, you know, and basically they were trying to make sure I wasn't smuggling stuff in. And really the philosophy was, look, you may be a nice guy, but actually you're lending covert support. Not in this case to religious terrorists, but to some other kind of terrorists. And I think there are two things I want to say in response to your question. So I think it's a very good and fair question. Number one, fanatics need to be named. They need to be named by those in whose name they are acting, whether it is religious or political or ethnic or whatever. You know, this is really how we go about building a civilized society. Something needs to be done about it. And secondly, again, for me as a Christian, it is enormously important to be able to say, you are doing this in the name of Christianity. Will you consider the example of Jesus? Because he critiques what you are saying, and I want to ask whether you have any right to say that. So I would certainly join with you in wanting to critique these people. I think we may have a different approach to how we do it, but certainly it is a major question on the cultural agenda at the moment and one that I really hope is pursued. Thank you.
Great. Now, we've just got about five people left on each side, so I'm going to ask nobody else to join them. I'm going to ask all of you to ask your questions really quickly and for the speakers to answer quickly, because we have to go by 9:30. I'm not quite sure that you answered why people voted for George Bush, but I'm not sure any human being can answer that question. So we'll move on.
Sue, one of your main points of argument was evolution, and that alongside evolution of human beings, there was evolution of religion. And over a period of time, religion became embedded into humanity. And do you have any views of religion in the future? What fate has religion got in the future? You said that one of the main triggers of evolution of religion was writing, and that people wrote and copied bits that only they liked. Will in the future we continue taking bits that we like? And in this case, will religion be possibly an even more so dangerous delusion?
I wish I could answer that question for two reasons. One, I'd like to know what's... Stay there so I can see you. Partly because I'd like to know what's going to happen, and partly because it would be wonderful for memetics if it could do that. Now, of course, evolutionary theory is well known for not being able to predict specifics, but predict the general principles. We ought at least to be able to do that. We ought to be able to say things like, with the internet and massive intercommunications, the religions are meeting in small ways all over the place rather than in big clashes through crusades and so on. That should give a different dynamic to the whole process. Much more scientific education should cause people to question, but then we know that it's very, very hard to get science and scientific thinking to actually change these deep-seated beliefs. So in fact, it may not have that much effect. But we could, I think, more ask which tricks will stop working. There have lots of babies and contraception trick. Things are moving too fast. That trick is falling away. But other tricks of proselytizing and evangelism and so on are working better with television and so on. So we should be able to do those things. But before Kathy stops me, that's the sort of general direction I would take.
It's a great question, though, the predictive power of memetics, because scientific theories need to be able to predict, don't they? And that might help you in 10 years' time change your mind or not. Thank you.
First of all, it was a brilliant debate. It was wonderful to hear you talk, and thank you very much for being here. It was great to be here. When I, realisation of becoming an atheist, one of the big things I took on board was the justification that everything I did was only, I had no justification of a higher power. If I did something wrong, I could not say that it was because of original sin or that Satan tempted me or anything like that. I was only justified for to myself. And in a sense, that made me very, very altruistic, almost a sense that the more fundamentalist atheist I came, as clumsy a phrase that is, the more altruistic and, the more I wanted to encourage the cooperation of mankind. We're the only ones here, and we must work together. in another sense, quoted interestingly, The Root of All Evil by Richard Dawkins, that there is a passage, and I think it might be in the chapter John's, I'm not sure though, that actually justifies saying that if someone, even your friends and family, specifically it mentions your friends and family, asked you to investigate another religion, not only must you kill them, you must be the first person to launch the first stone to kill them. In a sense that killing someone else because they've suggested another religion, you can actually find justification for that in the Bible. So, unfortunately, I must disagree with your comparison almost between fundamentalist atheists and, fanatical atheists and fanatical Christians, and such that the more fanatical atheists you become, the more altruistic you become, and the more fanatical religious you come the other way. I'm sorry for taking so much time. I'd love to hear a response.
Every other question has to be briefer than that. Sorry. Go ahead. Yes, and the answer,
well,
too.
Obviously, you and I disagree on this, I think, rather strongly. I mean, Dawkins' suggestion that religious people ought to kill their children for disobeying them, I mean, from a Christian perspective, is nonsense. I just want to put that on the table there and then. That is not a Christian idea. That's Dawkins reading the Old Testament. That's not how Christians read the Old Testament. Your point about, atheism and the collaborative sort of thing, that sounds like Nietzsche. And one of Nietzsche's points is, he talks about the death of God, but then with great sadness he asks, where does this take us? And the answer is, it leads us to the herd instinct. Nietzsche proclaimed the death of God, but actually was deeply distressed by it, because he believed this removed any transcendent metaphysical referent, and therefore in effect just opened the way to, this is what I think, this is what the powerful think, this is what we're going to do. And again, if I had time, I'd want to look at Iris Murdoch's idea in The Sovereignty of Good, which I think emphasized the importance of a transcendent good, whether theistic or just transcendent, for stabilizing moral values. But then, we're running out of time, so that's just the sketch outline of an answer.
I think just one quote per answer from now. Sue wanted to add something, though.
I'd just throw in a thought there. I think this is something that we really need more in our society, where we've got lots and lots of atheists or agnostics, or not, I don't think you'd really be a fanatical atheist, but someone who really doesn't think there's a God. We need to work better at taking that, what you have found, that tendency to think, okay, if I'm responsible, gosh, I can actually find within myself this desire to be good. My dad, who's 91 and has Alzheimer's, doesn't know what day it is or anything else. I recently had a really poignant discussion with him because I was going off to some debate of this kind, and he said, but of course there's a God. Otherwise, why would we want to be good? And he couldn't let go of God, but what you've done is to let go and find, actually, we still do want to be good. And I would like to see us better in our society. People are trying in schools and so on, but we need to do better to nurture and encourage that very natural human sense of wanting to be good and make the most of it away from religion.
Thank you. So we can be good without God. In fact, we might even be even better, you're saying. Go ahead.
A question to whoever really wants to take it. I particularly enjoyed both speakers speaking on how it's obviously gone straight out of my head.
Do you want to remember and I'll go to the other side? Have you got it?
Yeah, please go.
Right, we'll come back to you. Go ahead.
Okay, last week I heard on GMTV, somebody thought that Harry Potter was more popular than the Bible. And so I wonder what you feel about this, with your mind and view about the Christian faith.
I think Harry Potter's great. Do you know, when the meme machine came out, somebody rang me up and said, sorry, this is a kind of big-headed thing, they rang me up and said, look at Amazon, the meme machine's at number 5. Wow! It has this rank order of all the million books, and it was at number 5 only for about 5 minutes. But anyway, I thought, well, what are the other 4? And they were these things I'd never heard of. It was Harry Potter 1 paperback, Harry Potter 1 hardback, Harry Potter 2 paperback, and so on. So I went and read them. Ah, yeah, terrific. Sorry, I don't understand the problem. Harry Potter are fantastic books. The Bible is a horrible, horrible book full of beastly things and a few nice
things. But isn't the Bible not the Bible about real life? Surely it is.
Pardon?
For those who believe in God, the Bible speaks about true life, not an imaginary fantasy.
Yeah, that's fine. For people who want to read it that way. I have read it recently, and I've read it long ago, and it shocks me, some of the things in it. There are some wonderful things in it there. There are some wonderful examples of things that Jesus did, and some of them are stirring and nice, but the book as a whole is horrible.
Great, that's the title for another debate, I think, hosted by the IAS, possibly next year. Go ahead.
Okay, has come back to me. I enjoyed speaking on Jesus' example and how we should follow this. And also how good people will want to be good, and how obviously fanaticism isn't part of the religious, most religions' teachings as a whole. But personally, I can't think of any conflicts or major conflicts that have been begun over whether Van Gogh is better than Monet or Shostakovich is far better than Tchaikovsky. So does religion not provide far too good an excuse?
But
yes.
I think that's for Alistair probably to answer, really.
Yes. Well, I'll just say yes.
Again, we're running out of time. So very, very briefly, I mean, certainly, I mean, one can imagine this kind of academic debate also being very, very well-natured leading to violence. But the real issue is that when things really, really, really matter to people, whether they are religious, anti-religious, or something else, then sooner or later, I'm afraid, it's going to lead to violence. That is one of the saddest truths that emerges from anthropology. And I think it's very, very distressing. But the key thing is, when things really matter to people, that is what's going to happen. And the real issue is, how does civilization cope with this, enabling people to value things, but at the same time enabling them to live, to coexist with those who value different things? And that seems to me to be, again, a critical question in this very troublesome period that we live in.
Thank you.
So, how would you answer claims by Christians that they witness a lot of healings and miracles done, not just they're believing Jesus did them in the Bible, but they're seeing them today? I've witnessed people being healed in Bristol, even in the last few weeks, when praying for them specifically in the name of Jesus to the God of the Bible. Now, that seems to me more than just the power of the mind to be able to do that, to heal slip disc, to heal somebody with celiac disease, various other things. I've seen people with bent spines healed and then made straight.
I wonder whether you actually have seen that. Mm-hmm. I become utterly cynical here, and this is one of the reasons I got out of parapsychology, which is very closely allied to all these kinds of claims of healing. I got out because I became cynical rather than open-minded anymore. But it took me 30 years of open-minded investigation. I saw horrible things. I saw mostly generous, kind, and nice people being utterly deluded by paranormal claims, but no the less harmful for that. But I also saw horrible charlatans, and you get more of those in the healing world than anywhere else. There are lots and lots and lots of tricks. I mean, the very simplest thing is, most people in wheelchairs can actually walk, and if they do, they're going to damage themselves. So you do this amazing thing and they suddenly feel inspired and they get up and walk, and it does them a lot of harm, and you never see that. Most people who are blind, so-called, can actually see something, and if you get the conditions right and so on, they can be inspired to think they can see more than they can. Most people with all sorts of awful illnesses, they'll have remissions. There are all kinds of tricks that you can play way beyond that, and people play them. Now, I don't know what you've seen. I have to retain sufficient open-mindedness to say it might be true, but I got to the point after 30 years... Most of it was parapsychology, not healing, but some of it was this. I got to the point after 30 years where again and again and again, I'd done the long, slow, hard work of investigation, and in the end, it always came to nothing. I don't know, but that's what I suspect.
Can I just ask one more question? Were they occultic healings, or were they done in the name of Jesus, the ones that you investigated?
Mostly they were hands-on things, or they were kind of Brazilian, amazing stuff, but some were done in the names of different religions. It was a long time and lots of different things. I didn't discriminate them particularly, I'm sorry.
Okay, just suggest that maybe
it'd
be best to
look
at the source.
No,
Sue,
no.
I don't think Sue's going back there.
No, I'm not going back there.
There is an enormous power, even scientific evidence suggests, in the power of the mind and belief in terms of healing.
Massive placebo effect.
Massive placebo effect. That's how many scientists might... have a take. Over there.
Thank you. Can I make a comment? It's not a question. In my own experience of religion, and I particularly emphasise the word meaning in life, it's a plea, really. It's to say I would have liked to feel there's more weight, more understanding given to the way in which the individual human develops and gains a sense of meaning within themselves. I'm not academic, but I could quote Winnicott, who could talk movingly about development of small children, very movingly, and although an atheist could speak to, could address people and talk about, quote, the everlasting arms, and whereas the first speaker would look evidence for religion, what's the effect of religion, how many, what percentage of people pray, does it make a difference to their lives? That's one area of investigation. The second speaker might say, well, here I am, and I believe this thing from outside makes sense to me. My plea is, can we please, could one also consider what makes sense within and what sense do we already carry within us from our very early experiences? And when that has to be put right, that's I found that a very, very difficult thing in myself, and I think it's a very valuable area of consideration.
Thank you.
The meaning of life is important, but I think we all make our own meanings. Oddly enough, I have found one of the most comforting thoughts in life is when I think, but what's the point of it all? The most comforting thought is, there's no point. Just get on with it. There's no point. And somehow, for me, that is... And I know that for other people, that leads to despair. So I just try to think, okay, we're all different. But... that works for me.
And Sue and I are different on this point, I think. Yes. And we could doubtless have a very good conversation about this.
Thank you. Go ahead, briefly.
Again, not really a question, but I just wanted to say to you, Sue, that I thought your concept of the giant spaghetti monster was absolutely absurd. And it does hurt me deeply to hear you say that, because
I'm going to be very offended. I can feel it coming on.
I really
don't think you should speak like that.
I know for a fact that you're actually talking about the whole wheat tagliatelle monster.
No, I'm not. It's white spaghetti.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But you made your point very well.
My question is to Sue, Speaker One. I'm just doing a bit of information gathering, and I noticed your point about the 72 virgins for killing a non-Muslim. Actually, I just wanted to know what the reference was for that, because it's either from the Quran, hopefully, if that's if you're going to choose that as a reliable source of representing Islam, which it is. And that's a limited book, so if you're going to find that, you're going to find it. Or the Hadith, and you should be able to find a chain of narrators going up to it, or you might have chosen the Daily Mirror instead. And I'm just wondering where exactly you got it from, so I can actually check it up genuinely, because I've never heard it from any Islamic scholar.
Right. I think for the purposes of mentioning it today, I got it from Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, because I read that and I only finished reading it a few days ago. But I did, about 2 or 3 years ago, read the whole of the Quran, and it's certainly in there, though I wouldn't swear it's 72. I mean, I could have forgotten it. But I do not have a reference, but I'm sure you could find it out much better than by asking me.
No, I've asked others as well, and I've never managed to actually get to you. Yeah, because actually no Islamic scholar ever supports the...
I will go and do some investigation too.
Yeah. Well, can I suggest you exchange email's address afterwards? Yeah, and if you find it, you tell us. Yeah. I'm serious.
Yes.
You're laughing, I'm serious.
Fine. Yes,
yeah, I just wanted
because it's banded around enough, isn't it?
I just wanted to express that... the kind of authenticity of the religion
it's a very powerful meme, because people like to be able to laugh at it even though they're not supposed to laugh, and if it's not there somewhere, then we should know about it and go and tell people. I'm pretty sure that it will turn out to be, but if it isn't, that's very interesting.
Thank you, and please do stay and leave your email address.
Right,
please
thanks.
Do, and so I'm sure, and Sue will follow it up.
Hi, so I have a question for you. Your claim that any religion... any belief in God is dangerous to religion is such a broad and generous statement. As a South Korean Christian whose family came from North Korea to flee from communist regime, in my experience and in my reflection of Korean history, actually Western missionaries came in the end of 19th century and made such a big difference. They made a modern schools. At least they made a differences in at least in two areas. First of it, our culture is very oppressive to women, but those missionaries educated women and who even to had a vote, a right to vote. And secondly, those missionary schools trained the nationalist leaders who fought against the Japanese Empire. So in my reflection of religion or Christianity, actually it made huge difference. So I'm just wondering, to to what extent do you think your particular claim is based on your experience as a Western European intellectual who lives in the 21st century?
You're absolutely right, it is. It's a very good point, and it certainly is. Nevertheless, I would answer that at least partly by saying just because religions are dangerous, as I've claimed, doesn't mean they don't do some good. And just because horrible atheist regimes do horrendous harm doesn't change the fact that religions can as well. As for missionaries, well, they're a mixed bag, aren't they? I mean, there are many missionaries which went and utterly destroyed the societies they went into. On the whole, missionaries have done wonderful things like setting up schools and so on, and when you look on that side of it, that's great. But often it's at the cost of the children in those schools accepting the belief.